You're listening to the Franchise Podcast Network, presented by Lucky Star Casino. KRXO-FM and KRXO-HD Oklahoma City, a product of Tyler Media, reaching over 1 million Oklahomans every week. Now, the Outdoor Hour, giving you the inside scoop on the great outdoors on 107.7 The Franchise.
As long as I can remember, I've been drawn to the outdoors. There's something primal in each of us that awakens when we step outside the bounds of modern society and back into the vast possibilities of the natural world. The more civilized our lives become, the louder our hearts cry for reconnection with our native ways. Failure is imminent, dangers drawing nigh, but approached with reverence and tact, the outdoors return wisdom and gain. In both the outdoors and in life, harvests are fleeting, but lessons and memories abound. With that in mind, we step forth boldly together in pursuit of ourselves outdoors. We are nothing more than tree stand troubadours. Welcome inside the Outdoor Hour. You can cut the tension with a knife this week. Holy cow. Back in studio. Part two. Am I alone in this?
You're alone.
You're never alone with me, Taylor.
Thank you.
Creepy. I'm always watching you.
We don't need to bring that kind of energy to start this episode.
I didn't think so either.
Yet here we are.
You know, that Puff Daddy song, it sure hits a lot different now, doesn't it?
Okay. Back to waterfowl.
Let's go ahead and jump right in. Goldfish, are you queued up and ready this week?
Yeah, I'm ready to go. Let's go.
This is the Outdoor Hour. I'm Taylor Maples. I just shot a bear. That's Joshua Wildman Stratton.
Wildman Stratton.
On the ones and twos and on time this week, the one and only Matty Goldfish.
Always baked and extra cheesy.
I love that goldfish.
Three for three. Let's see how this one goes.
And back in studio this week, I feel like we just began to scratch the surface a week ago on everything this guy
does. I may have derailed it. I may have taken us down a couple of rabbit holes.
May have. This is part two. This is Keenan Taylor in studio with us.
Hello.
Welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Yeah. I think we should dive right in, man. We were talking a little bit about ducks. This is going to be a shock to no one. I'm wildly unprepared this week. I had planned to bring some duck calls in, to have you bring some calls, to do some stuff like that. I had a couple other things top of mind that I wanted to get into this week, and I can't remember what either of them were. So over the course of the episode, we'll try to jog my memory a little bit.
Wife with Taylor. That's what that was just there.
Yeah, we always have
great
visions.
There was one time he told us about he was going to bring us jerky. I think he told us for like at least a year. Almost every episode. Eventually it showed up.
It was good. I've brought you food a few times.
My wife calls those virtual gifts.
Virtual gifts?
I'm full of virtual gifts.
I thought about it. I like that.
I do like that. I like that.
Virtual gifts.
Virtual gifts. It's like our friendship, Taylor.
Yeah. It's virtually a gift. I did have a conversation before we dive into the duck stuff. I had a conversation with Dallas Barber this week, big game biologist for your Oklahoma Department Wildlife Conservation. I saw something on Facebook. It was a reel about spotted fawns late in the year, and it meaning that the does were being bred basically in multiple cycles, and that it'll also cause your bucks to hold their antlers a little bit longer into the spring. And like most people should, I question just about everything I see on Facebook. So I reached out to Dallas Barber, and I said, hey, I sent him the video. I said, do you have any thoughts on this? Because I am not very well informed. And he came back and said, all 100% true. Spotted fawns late in the year, think like October on, are a telltale sign of a poor buck-to-doe ratio. Because it means all your does aren't being bred at the same time, and they're basically going through a second heat cycle.
getting bred later, having later fawns, and it's causing your buck testosterone numbers, essentially, to not follow their natural cycle, and the bucks are holding their antlers later in the year. So there you go. If you guys are, like we are, seeing fawns past October with spots, means your doe population is probably out of whack. So there's a good tidbit. And I even asked this week for permission if I could quote Dallas in the show. A lot of times I just do it anyways. This time I said, hey, can I actually go on the record with this? And he said yes. So there you go. Learn something.
There you go.
Speaking of learning something, I've got the feeling, Keenan, that you know a little bit more about duck hunting from like a biological standpoint, an ecosystem standpoint, more than just like calling birds and shooting birds than I do, or maybe anybody we've talked to. Why is it that your professional background, first of all, what do you do, and why does that make you a great duck hunting resource?
Yeah, so my college degree is plant and soil science. So my option was crop science. So I'm a crop consultant. I mentioned that last time by trade. And so a lot of the things we do in duck hunting, habitat management, and it all correlates. So, I mean, we're growing corn and milo and millets. Those are some of the common ones in our units, and then flooding them for ducks. So it just, they go hand in hand. So naturally, it's where I can take a piece of my career and implement it in my hobby and my passion, or what's become my passion. So.
And it's interesting. I feel like you're kind of unlocking my brain in a little bit different way of thinking, because obviously you can't bait waterfowl.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as you go a couple steps before that and you plant things.
Brutal. I don't know if we should go down this road.
You know, one of my favorite jokes that I've run across is something I saw once, but guy spills a whole bag of corn where he plans to hunt. And the concept was, this is in a state where, you know, you can't bait deer like we can in Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. He says, well, this is going to be my deer hunting thing, but I'm feeding squirrels, right? This corn is for the squirrels. If any deer show up, I'm going to kill them because that corn is for the squirrels. It probably doesn't stand up with the game warden. So
I don't think so. Yeah. No.
No.
Same type of thing applies. Don't be out there dropping corn for your ducks. But it is really interesting because that's something, you know, me as a very novice, I don't know very much about land management. But I know that I've got properties that we have a lot more ducks, and I know we have properties that don't hold any birds. And it's interesting, I've never really even looked at, well, what is there for vegetation? I've always thought about what does the water look like, what's happening with the weather patterns to bring birds in. But it sounds like you've got a very different filter through which you can look at why that is going to hold birds and why that is not.
Yeah, so when I first got into this, you know, I was helping, I'd mentioned last time with Kyle Sanders 737, the cropping side of his duck club, his corn and milo and some other various things that he's planted and tried, growing those. That's a small facet. Then you have the whole moist soil management, your smart weeds, barnyard grasses, different sedges, yellow nut sedge, all of those, and in crop production, those are all weeds. So I'm trying to kill them and get rid of them, and keep them out, keep it as clean as possible. Well, and those are major parts of a duck's diet. So managing my duck property and learning the whole moist soil management has been a whole other area that's it's actually really complex. Going from trying to kill it to now what's the creating an environment where it can come back naturally. Yes, you can plant those, but there's things we do draw down the water slowly, pretty much mimicking the environment. So in the summer, or you have all these spring rains and we pull water everywhere, and then when it gets hot and dry, the water evaporates and slowly draws down, and then you get an abundance of smart weeds or other things like that, where if you draw down water too early, then you can get sump weed and cockle burrs and a lot of plants that you necessarily don't want in your unit. So that's been not challenging for me, but it's been a whole other aspect I've had to learn, and how the cultural practices to implement on not just the crops, but in order to make a more hospitable environment for the moist soil plants, learning how to do that and the strategies behind that. And that's been really cool too. So, sorry, that was a really kind of...
No, I'm just processing a lot here, because like I said, I've never thought about the vegetation and the crops, and even like you're saying, how you can manipulate access to water and the pooling and all of that to help facilitate the type of growth that you want for certain naturally occurring plants.
Exactly.
And then the output of that is a more habitable space for your ducks.
Right.
Okay, so you've got a very controlled area, right? Because you own it, you've got access to it constantly, you can manipulate this. This is not a conversation probably for people that are hunting public property, because they can't manipulate it. Maybe you can help educate them on where to look to help scout better public property. Am I understanding correctly, though, that the conversation we could have about things to introduce and how someone might manipulate a piece of ground is probably more reserved for someone that owns their own land, right?
Right. Yeah, but if you're out scouting in the summer, I mean, there's probably not a lot of duck people who do that, but if you do, I mean, look for sedges and smart weeds and barnyard grasses. Recognize those plants. If they're along, they're going to be along the edges of banks and in sloughs and in other areas. And if you know where there's that food source, then, I mean, it's a great place to start if you're needing to scout public property to figure out where there might be a viable food source for your ducks in the winter.
How does different species of duck respond differently to different types of vegetation?
Yeah, so mallards, for instance, like a shallow water, where they can just kind of wiggle their flippers and kind of stir the seeds off the bottom, and then they nibble them. Yellow nut sedge, it grows a little tuber underground, and they call it cocaine for ducks or for
yeah.
turkeys.
Okay.
Not chowpa, excuse me. So, yeah, chufa is just a commercialized name for yellow nut sedge. But so those might be areas for mallards. Now the seeds, they also produce a seed. I have one unit that I have an abundance of yellow nut sedge, and my pintails, that's where they want to be. So they just draw to that type of seed. You know, pecans, there's a big debate. I mean, everybody I ask buddies and some of my mentors in the moist soil, you know, about pecans, because I have a lot of pecan trees. Well, ducks really don't eat pecans. All I know, where I have pecans, where my wood ducks are. So, and mallards later in the season. I haven't shot a mallard and opened it up to see if there's been pecans in there. But all I know, wherever I have a pecan tree, I have mallards and wood ducks. So, yeah. So, I mean, there's that. And then, you know, the government, they used to spread a lot of millet, you know, on the banks, you know, when the lakes would be down in July and August, and they would spread millet along the banks, and it'd grow up. And then when we get our fall rains, the lakes come up and you have your millet underwater. And millet's not just good for seed production. I mean, invertebrates like the habitat created by millet. So, and you say, you know, different ducks or different, you know, species like different things. And so when it's warm outside, like right now, ducks are hitting more of the moist soil plants and the barnyard grasses and all that. All my Milo I have planted, nothing's touching it. That'll be for more when it's cold. It seems like they want it more, corn especially. And there's more energy units in corn and milo and rice is a big one. So it's like the duck naturally wants different things during different times of the year and different temperatures.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. I can draw a parallel to how we would feed deer in Oklahoma to keep them around. You know, we'll do protein throughout kind of late spring, summer. We'll switch to corn once we really start getting close to hunting season. And then we'll start throwing in like some rice bran or something like that. Typically, we'll go later in the season. The guys I usually hunt with around Christmas will start throwing that out. And that's the same way with bucks. We call it, you know, cocaine for bucks because
right.
It feels like, man, if you can get a buck on that rice bran, what we'll do is we'll lay down, we call it a pallet, but we'll lay down some corn to just give us some a little bit of insulation from the ground because that rice bran stuff is really susceptible to moisture. So we'll lay down a bunch of corn just to kind of give some separation and some of that rice bran on it. Man, if you can get a buck's nose in that rice bran, he's going to be on the property.
Wow.
But so that's that concept is really familiar to me. I have just never made the jump that, and part of it's I grew up hunting public, and I've never had my own property for ducks to go in and actually work to manipulate. I don't know that I've ever sat here before 20 minutes ago and said, I wonder if you can manipulate your property and the vegetation to hold birds or to attract certain birds. I feel like I need to rethink every conversation I've had with waterfowlers. You know, we've had the guys from Falco. We've had some of these people that do this at a high, high level. And, Josh, I'm sure they're thinking this way. I'm sure they've got people on staff that make these decisions. And I'm just blown away. I never thought about this as an asset for duck hunting.
Yeah, I mean, most of these lodges, you know, particularly ones that are going to create their own wetlands or that's their intent, they're hiring someone like Keenan to come in and help them establish that plan. Some of them just have enough knowledge from being in the industry, I think, you know, enough to be dangerous and to do it at a decent way. I think where it gets super interesting, though, is being able to leverage someone like Keenan to say, hey, I want to holistically look at this piece of property, and I want to do a couple of things. One, I want to try to restore it back to its original in the sense of biodiversity, and I want to remove non-indigenous plants, and I want to turn this thing back into what, you know, for Oklahoma, for instance, let's say you're in one of the more prairie regions, whether that's a tall or short grass prairie, saying, hey, I want to rebuild this to what it was supposed to look like. And I also want to do that to the benefit of holding more animals and to having higher harvest rates. And that's where, you know, whether that's working with, you know, Oklahoma Department of Wildlife or working with someone like Keenan, you can really accomplish some wonderful things of not just doing a legacy work of restoring a land back to what it was supposed to look like, but creating a piece of property that can actually sustain a diverse population of native animals from this region, as well as an appealing holdover property for migrating animals that are, you know, coming through the area. And I mean, that's my personal interest in having land, is to cultivate something back to what it was supposed to be before we screwed it all up.
Yeah, for sure. Man, I need to like marinate with this new knowledge for a few minutes. Let's take a break. When we come back, we got more with Keenan Taylor inside the Outdoor Hour on 107.7 The Franchise.
You're listening to the Outdoor Hour with your host Taylor Maples and Josh Stratton on 107.7 The Franchise.
Welcome back inside the Outdoor Hour. During the commercial break, things got a little heated in here in the studio.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah. We're going to take this in a little bit different direction now, though, because, Josh, you brought up a good point, and we've had this comment made in the show in the past. I don't remember which episode. But you brought up during the commercial break your opposition to feeding in general. We were talking about deer.
Well, corn feeding.
Corn feeding.
Yes. Yeah, it's lazy, first off. Like, it just is, in my opinion. And y'all, You know my social. You can all hit me up.
Find him at against underscore current.
But, yeah, I think that what we're trying to do is we're trying to maximize our time in the outdoors by taking an option that we know a feeder that's programmed that we don't have to consistently check on. We can fill it with as much corn as we want. It's going to keep the deer when we want them so that when we show up, it's we're playing hopefully by our rules instead of nature's rules a little bit. Right? We all know that turns out they love to go nocturnal, right? Or pressure turns on and they start changing their behavior. But there are a lot of downsides to feeding in that way. If we were taking a holistic land management approach, that may be a little bit of what you do, but it's not all that you do. When you're managing that property with the intent of recreation through hunting, there's a lot of things you're going to do. And Keenan, like, jump in here, but like, you're going to look at a lot of what's going on there. Consistency of water. Do you have water? Can you create water? Does it make sense for you to maybe create a creek through that property? You're going to look at the diversity of plots and food, flora and fauna that are there, right? You're going to...
Yeah, I mean, monoculture is not good for anything. So, you know, do you have water? You know, you need to start. Can you get water? If you dump your water, if you take your water off units, can you get it back? Yeah. We need water for duck season, you know? And then if you can, then that opens up a new window. Well, do we moist soil management? Do we do hot crops? That's a term in waterfowl we use for corn, milo, rice, is hot crop. Do we hot crop it? Or do we have a mixture of both? Or if you have a lot of corn, it makes ducks want to roost there. So you just have the ducks at night and then they leave, you know? So yes, there's, you know, yes, but you don't want one thing across it. We want,
right. And then my other thing is when we talk about a state that now has exposure to CWD, any time that we are pulling in and pushing into closer quarters herds, we are increasing the likelihood of CWD spreading. It is a herd density issue. Once it's there, it's there. But how do we eliminate those encounters or make them fewer? Well, stop feeding corn.
Not to mention, you know, there's other, I don't know, the
aflatoxins.
There you go. Mm-hmm. I was just going to say toxins. Aflatoxins that are having detrimental effects on, you know, bird species, like you mentioned quail and turkeys. We know that the turkey numbers across the state have not been in a great place in recent times. Also introduction of other predators, right? Like just looking at my lease as a small ecosystem, we joke all the time that every time I go dump corn, we're just feeding raccoons.
Yep.
You know, we've got Boone and Crockett raccoons on our property, and that's not good for anything, especially my pocketbook, right? So
right.
I think that as the weekend warrior deer hunter who grew up in a state where you couldn't feed corn, and having moved here, you know, the low-hanging fruit excuse for me is, well, it's allowed here. You know, it's what the state regulations allow us to do, and it's the cultural norm, and it took some getting used to on my part, but I have learned to love it and appreciate it. Josh, I think you're going to say, well, the state needs to look at that. And you guys in this room are much smarter than I and could help come up with a whole list of real justifiable reasons why. But I think that the higher level there is just because it's allowed doesn't mean that we all need to play at that common denominator.
If the number one motivator and the number one approval rating for hunting in America, as well as the number one motivator to participate, is to put a better quality of food in your body, why are you filling it with something that humans aren't allowed to eat? The corn that you are putting in your feeder and then putting into the deer that you are then going to eat is not approved for human consumption. That's real simple to me. Don't do it. I'm not trying to eat that.
It's hard to argue with. You know a little bit more, Keenan, about like the approval process, the science behind that statement.
Yeah, so when we deliver corn, you know, they test it for aflatoxins, and essentially is what's happening. And it's a problem, and not to dive too deep, but one thing that causes aflatoxins in corn is when your nights don't cool down in Oklahoma, the ear on the plant can't cool off, so it can't rest. Well, it can't fight off diseases and aflatoxins and fusariums and other issues, so it consumes the ear. So as a crop consultant, first thing I'm doing when I'm walking fields in the morning, I'm peeling back the shuck and I'm filling the ear to see how warm it is. If it's hot at 6:30 in the morning, that's not good. That plant didn't rest last night. Well, so what's going on after that is you take this load of corn to the mill and they reject it. Where are they going to go with that? If they don't have a place to take it and blend it with the corn that has less aflatoxins, I'm not saying this is what happens, but I know what corn looks like that has aflatoxins. And when I open a bag of deer corn of my own, you have these little shriveled up kernels. That's a pretty good indicator that it was maybe not such a good quality corn, and that maybe an avenue they're getting rid of it. And then it's going to our turkeys or our quail, deer. And not only can it kill cattle, it can deer or turkeys, but it can sterilize them. Well, that's my take on it, is why are we allowed to feed it to the wildlife but not the cattle? I mean, I see Josh's stance on it's not real a natural way to bring animals in. It kind of I don't know the word for it, but it's not as natural way of hunting or doing things. So, you know, it's manipulating it.
Which, we're all manipulating the environment, right? That's what we're doing. We're hunting, whether we're covering up our scent, whether we're dressing up in camo, whether we're putting a silence, you know, suppressor on a rifle, whether we're getting in a deer blind, you know, a stand, a blind, whatever. We're all manipulating the environment. I'm not naive to that. And even if you're building food plots and creating pressure points to try to get them to go certain ways on your property versus another way that's going to, you know, funnel them into where you happen to be posted up, that's all manipulation. But something about those things feel better to me than I'm just going to go put a deer stand up and a camera on it and I'm going to hum toxic corn out all over my landscape.
Right. Yeah, and I think that's where there needs to be some sort of procedure in testing that. We shouldn't be able to give that to the hunter to feed because we can't use it anywhere else.
So it is something that the state allows, and it is something that is a very common practice here for deer hunters. Are there things that we can do to help limit those toxins? And I'll give you a prime example. I've got two big, you know, livestock size plastic tubs in the back of my pickup that when I buy my corn, that you're right, is all shriveled and, you know, it doesn't look fit for consumption, I'm going to dump it straight into those things and I'm going to drive around with it in the back of my truck for 90 to 120 days. And it's just sitting out there in the heat, probably getting worse, right? Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, moisture is a big part, right?
Okay.
If moisture can get in there, so it's more like, and can speak to this better than I can, but I would assume this. Your risk at the beginning of the process is lower. When it's full, it's tight, not a lot of air, things aren't heating up and then creating condensation on the walls and so on and so forth. But as that starts to go down and you're creating space for condensation to build, for the change in temperatures from the mass of the corn to the air in between to the top throughout the day, yeah, I mean, you're exposing and increasing your chances of any type of bacteria growing in there.
Yeah, and I'm almost embarrassed to say this. Once, I don't know how the aflatoxins fluctuate once they're in the bin. I don't know.
I don't either.
That might be a good question for the feed
mill. The Googler.
Mm. Yeah, the Googler, the feed mill, or the nutritionist who would, you know, we have corn that's been in storage for a year and do the aflatoxins. I wouldn't think so, but I'm not sure.
That was my next question, is the 90 days of that corn sitting in the back of my truck is a very small percentage of its life cycle between what it's taken to get it to me in the first place. You know, so I guess really the question for me is there anything, assuming that people aren't going to stop hunting with corn, is there anything that I can and should be doing to have more of a positive role in this?
So to answer your question real quick, though, aflatoxin-producing fungi can contaminate corn in the field during harvest or during storage. So
yeah,
you're definitely, the risk of contamination increases in hot, dry conditions or when corn is damaged or moldy. So yes, throwing it in the back of your truck and letting it roast for months is increasing the chances. So says the Googler.
I mean, how many of those pallets are just sitting out behind name big box store where everybody goes to buy it? You know, it feels like, man, I wish I would have known this. Fortunately, I know it now. I'm not creating the problem. I've just always perpetuated it, you know?
Right.
So here's suggestions to reduce aflatoxin in corn.
Are you on a credible site here?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Integrated crop management website. Store grain at a moisture level below 12 to 13%. Cool grain below 60 degrees Fahrenheit as soon as possible. Aerate grain when it's 10 degrees warmer than the outside air and the humidity is below 65%. Inspect grain every 3 to 4 weeks. Use an in-bin drying system to dry high-moisture corn quickly.
Which all those things occur at any co-op. You have to.
Right. I mean, it's just when it gets to you.
It's when it gets to you and it's set in your 55-gallon barrel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, that's when the problem
is. I think that's the concern.
Those two-ton feeders that people will fill up one time a year and just shovel out of every time they run out.
Right. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know that we have a solution. I don't know that there's a quick fix.
It's carcinogenic as well.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
So, interesting.
Yeah.
You want to get an outsider's perspective?
I would love to.
Stop doing it, you idiots.
Get them, goldfish.
Why would you poison yourself? Stop it. And you're welcome.
Thank you.
I appreciate
that. No problem. It's what I provide.
Yeah. Oh, we appreciate you. I do know that ODWC has some thoughts and a bunch of super smart people who also are fully aware of this. Would be interesting to have them on sometime and see if they're willing to talk about it. And
yeah,
you know, we're not experts by any means. Well, I'm not. Taylor's not. You may be, Keenan, but we're not. We're just idiots who like it.
You made an interesting connection, though, when we were talking CWD, though, too, because it came up. I don't remember the specific microorganism term that was used there. I don't know. I'm not even going to say what I'm thinking.
Okay.
But it's of concern for a lot of reasons. So I think it is worth a bigger conversation.
Yeah, I think anytime you're pulling deer closer together,
mm-hmm.
In areas in particular that you know CWD is present, we have to be very, very careful about that.
Yeah. And obviously that the logical jump that you're making is if you've got a feeder, if you've got corn poured out in a pile, you are bringing them to a trough essentially to eat, and that is packing them in more densely than they would naturally be out west in more of a western spot and stock style of hunting.
Yeah, I mean, think about it in domestic terms. Feline AIDS, right? Feline AIDS, one wild cat has it. They get in a fight with another wild cat. They draw blood. Now that other cat has it. Very simple, right? So if you go feed the neighborhood cats all the time, they figure out pretty quickly, and all their friends start showing up at the same time every day. And what happens when they show up? Well, they fight. They do their things. They get territorial. They spread disease. They're all eating out of the same thing. Everything's happening. It's the exact same premise here. It lives in the soil. It can live in the soil. It stays there forever. And once something is contaminated with CWD, you cannot get it out.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're drawing deer in that potentially have it, and now they're contaminating those areas and contaminating other deer, and they're all coming back every day, and more friends are showing up until they get run off. Yeah, the likelihood of spread increases dramatically.
So I don't expect you to have an answer to this, Josh, but I'm going to ask. When I said at the beginning of the segment here that you were opposed to feeding, you quickly said corn feeding. Is there an alternate that you know of that we should be considering?
I mean, I think that's a question for Keenan, but my answer would be proper land management. Don't hit the easy button. Mm-hmm. Put in the work. Like, actually make sure that there are native plants, trees, and all those things on your property that they are looking for. Remove the non-indigenous. Remove the invasive. Create an environment where there's biodiversity, and you are going to naturally hold more wildlife. You're just going to.
You talked about the seasonality of their diet, specifically for ducks, and that's how we got in this conversation of feeding deer. But the first thing that comes to mind for me is acorns, you know, especially early on in the year. What's that?
Gherkins.
You know, that is something that would be probably less detrimental to the landscape, more naturally occurring, but there is a seasonality to it, at least in the deer diet cycle. So does your expertise stretch from waterfowl into deer in that way? Could you give recommendations?
Yeah, I mean, I could. And our, I would say that our deer food plots are legit. They look good. And they're diverse. We have, you know, I have a mixture in there, radishes and oats and wheat and rye. yeah, I laugh because we have a problem in cropping systems. It's Italian ryegrass. It's ALS resistant. So a lot of our herbicides aren't working on it. We can't kill it. And then people are buying these ryegrass mixes for their food plots. And myself included, I bought some with rye in it. And it came with Italian ryegrass, not a commercialized rye. I laugh because it's not just aflatoxins. It's we're bringing noxious weeds in with these food plots. But no, yeah, I think, you know, there's times of the year when the deer will quit feeding the corn because of the acorns. I was reading a deal the other day that bow hunters, really good bow hunters, will watch blue jays. And they'll hunt where blue jays are at because blue jays like fresh acorns. And I guess bucks will do the same. So wherever you hear them chirping or see them is where you should be bow hunting. Animals aren't just, deer aren't just deer. They're like humans. We like a variety. So it's, I don't know. I like ice cream when it's cold. Maybe the deer like that with acorns and everything else.
The simple answer, though, is food plots.
Right. Yeah, I think it's a lot more effective. You know, it's a continual source of protein. When the grass, Bermuda and all the other grasses die in the winter, our cereal grains are still growing great and gives the deer, turkey, and geese things to feed on.
And it's also rebuilding your soil back, right? So you're doing the things you need to be doing by rotating crops, by putting cover crops during certain times of the year, by doing those things that are putting the nutrition back into the soil to sustain that piece of property, right? You're not just being a taker. You're being someone who's building a system that has longevity, that has stability, that has diversity. And in that, you're just going to have a better experience across the board. You're going to see more birds, both those huntable and non-huntable, right? You're going to see a diversity in animals that are on that property. It's all going to level itself out. And as you create some of those cover crops that maybe aren't super tall, well, that becomes shelter, if you will, for rodents, right? Now you're going to start seeing more hawks because there's stuff for them to hunt. You're going to start seeing more owls. It all just feeds itself. And so when we choose the option of, I'm going to put out corn feeders, and you don't address any of the other issues that are wrong with that piece of ground, not only do I just not agree with that method, but you're also limiting your own personal experience of what that land could be and what your time looks like when you're there. Because you are going to see more. And going back to our previous conversation last episode about the duck blinding kids, same story here, right? if our kids are seeing more animals, if people who aren't into hunting, who aren't just like ate up and are going to sit in misery no matter what, are seeing more things that are beautiful and engaging to them, they're going to be a lot more likely to show up the next time, even if they weren't successful. And so if we care holistically for the pieces of ground that we're hunting, I think we create an experience that's more memorable. We create an experience that's better for the ecosystem as a whole. And now we're actually building something that's sustainable.
Yeah.
I think I'm a believer now. I think I'm sold. I'm rethinking every decision I've made on this piece of property. And honestly, like, I feel like I've learned a lot just in the last 30 minutes with you guys. And if someone like me says, okay, I'm a believer. I've gone from, you know, being a corn and rice bran baiting deer hunter to now I'm more interested in what types of food plots we could put out there and how this would work to create a more organically existing and sustainable and beneficial landscape, right, for the holistic view of the property. I mean, are you available to come out and advise? Are there people? How does someone like me go, okay, now that I'm educated on this, where do I go?
Right. I mean, I that's not my big business. I'm always willing to help, but there's the NRCS is a wealth of knowledge. They have a lot of resources. We have conservation districts throughout the state. You can rent a no-till drill for $8, $10 an acre, you know, if you don't want to go buy a drill. I mean, there's... You know, Oklahoma State has extension specialists, and then I believe every county has an extension specialist you can go to get advice. And there are people who do this for a living, that do wildlife habitat management, from ducks to deer. So yes, it's out there.
It's fascinating. I've got some more thoughts, but we got to squeeze in a break. So let's do that. We'll be back. One more segment ahead with Keenan Taylor inside the Outdoor Hour on 107.7 The Franchise.
Now back to the Outdoor Hour with your hosts Taylor Maples and Josh Stratton on 107.7 The Franchise.
Welcome back. Final segment this week. Taylor Maples, Joshua Wildman Stratton, and Keenan Taylor with you. I made a promise to you guys that I'd let you talk dogs a little bit before we got out of this week's show. So have at it, Josh.
Yeah, so I think we stirred the pot last week a little bit with our American lab versus British lab. And you mentioned one of your friends and colleagues in the Duck Club. They have some SOK dogs, Barton, there at Southern Oak Kennels, and I've been talking to him about dogs myself, and you know, we have to keep that on the quiet so my wife doesn't absolutely murder me, you know. But yeah, he was out in Europe last week and showing a bunch of videos of the lab lines that he, you know, brings back to the States. And I think, you know, some kennels there that he works with, but it looked like a week of European style hunting. And I saw agility out of these labs that, frankly, you know, maybe we just don't put him in those type of environments, or I'm not seeing him in that type of environment. You know, for me, I'm either running upland dogs or I'm hunting with people with duck dogs. I've never myself, as you and I have had this conversation, never had a just straight duck dog in my life. I've had versatile hunting dogs that had duck hunting capabilities, but not, you know, not like we think. I think most people think of a duck dog that's, you know, making all these blind retrieves, yeah, and multiple birds falling and the whole nine, right? And but man, it was super cool to see how agile these dogs were. The motor on some of them was super, super impressive, wicked fast. That wasn't most of them, which, to your point, it's why you're drawn to the American labs, in your opinion, just a little faster, got a little more grit to them.
Yeah. Hard driving. And I'm not saying, yeah, the British labs aren't in that, but
I heard you said they were soft,
softer. Well, everybody's always like, you know, I need something that has an off switch, you know, for the house. And that's why we went British. Now my partner on the Duck Club.
You know what's terrible is that's the exact same thing I said to him the first time he and I were talking dogs.
So, and ours do, but But yeah, I have a 7-year-old boy without an off switch, so yeah, they go hand in hand.
Yeah, so it works out great.
They wear each other out.
Yeah.
But no, my partner on the duck club, we were hunting timber over in eastern Oklahoma, and his southern oak dog, my first wood duck, killed it. His dog's name is Jock. Jock brings it up to me and drops it. And I'm like, and the wood duck, anybody knows about wood ducks, they swim. And I'm like, oh, my first wood duck was beautiful. I was going to mount it. And anyways, we're looking, never found it. And then like, I probably 3 or 4 hours later, we're packing up and the dogs are going. And here comes Jock with my bird. So my partner on the duck club, after I said what I said about British dogs last week, he's like, yep, my dogs aren't getting your birds anymore. It's a soft dog.
That's right. So. Man, super cool. I'm pretty far down the road mentally. I still, though, I'm like, there's also a giant part of me that just wants a black and tan coon hound. Just because. I mean, I'd love to get into coon hunting and maybe get them trained on some cats and be able to do that, but also track down deer for people here in Oklahoma now that that's, you know, a really growing need as people continue to come into hunting here in Oklahoma and maybe aren't taking the best of shots, or nature happens and someone needs to come find it. You know, it's only been a handful of years now that that's been legal in Oklahoma, so, but I don't know. I keep looking at these Southern Oak Kennel Black Labs and thinking, man, I probably need one of those around my house.
I got a place you can come hunt coons for sure. So
yeah, Boone and Crockett status.
Mm-hmm. These are biggins. These raccoons are so big, the guys that are on the lease with me, you know, we've got like a group chat, we will send each other trail cam pictures of just raccoons because they're that, like, it's worth having a conversation. Did you guys see this raccoon? So I'm here for a food plot. I am all about, if we can get off of the corn feeding out there, there's a lot of reasons I'd be interested in going in that direction. It's just not something that we've had many high-level conversations about, so I'm here for it.
Well, it does take time. Like, yeah. It is more time-consumptive. It is probably, particularly initially, probably not long-term. Maybe you can speak to that. I know we don't have much time, but it's a bigger investment on the front end than just going and getting a feeder and getting corn, both financially but also time-wise, right? And so when you're talking about working that land outside of hunting season and having the time to do that, that becomes really important if that's the route you're going to go. And frankly, not everyone has that freedom of time and resource to do that. But if you can and you do, I think everyone should.
And we are pressed for time here, but the last thought I have is I've been having a lot of conversations recently about trying to get out of what I would call ambush shooting. Anyways, I think that the way that I have come up as a bow hunter in Oklahoma is very much sit over top of a pile of corn and pretend that you're not there and just try to track and predict the movement of these animals to know when they're going to be there and just beat them there, right? Rattling in deer and using grunt calls and blats. Like, there's a lot of things, tools that I don't have in my tool belt as a deer hunter that I think allow you to have a different experience. You know, personally, I would say better experience, but that's just my own opinion. But help me to be a more well-rounded deer hunter besides just, hey, I put in the time, I sit in my stand every single day, and a deer's bound to show up, right? So that's the other thing that conversation leads me to is it possible for me to grow in my own development and formation as a deer hunter by adding some of these other tools in my tool belt and give me the opportunity to not be so reliant on a pile of corn to harvest deer? And those are just questions I'm asking myself, and I challenge our listeners to ask yourselves those questions, and then let's go on this journey together. Let's do it.
Let's do it.
Let's do it. Keenan, thanks for being here.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah. We'll have to have you back again.
Yeah.
Probably not a part three next week, per se, but shortly, let's get you back in the studio with us.
Yeah, yeah. Next week will be red fishing recap.
We're both chasing reds next week.
Yeah.
Different places.
Right.
I'm headed out Sunday, and I'm fishing Tuesday, Wednesday.
So it looks like a re-air next week, then.
No, not necessarily. We could call in. We could
both
be something.
Us?
We'll figure it out. I got a podcaster. We could do.
I could call you.
Yeah. Okay. We'll discuss that in our own time.
Well, you'll have to wait to see what happens.
You'll have to wait and see. Might be something from the road next week. Keenan Taylor, thanks for joining us this week. Taylor underscore K underscore T on Instagram. Anything else?
Send all your hate mail to
Goldfish.
Taylor Maples.
At TylerMedia.com. Actually, it's Taylor.m.
Thank you.
No problem.
Thanks for that, Goldfish.
No problem.
Send your advertising inquiries to Taylor.m at TylerMedia.com. We'd love to have you support the show.
We would. It's a good time.
Send me an email, Matthew.g at TylerMedia. Why not?
Do it.
I just made it even. I put your info out. I'll put mine out.
There you go. Text Maddie on his cell at...
I'll respond.
There you go. We need a text line for the show. We really do. We've got some good stuff cooking here for the Outdoor Hour.
Well, that's, again, life with Taylor. That's what I keep hearing.
We've got some good stuff cooking. All right. That's Joshua Wildman Stratton, against underscore current on Instagram. You can find me, T underscore Maples, on Instagram and Twitter. You can also follow the show at Outdoor underscore Hour on TikTok, Instagram, and Twitter. Some behind-the-scenes content, as well as some more footage from our lives out in the field. That's going to do it this week for the Outdoor Hour. On behalf of the whole crew here, thanks for being with us. Until next week, go boldly. We'll see you outdoors.